Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kate Stetson for the petitioners. We're going to be splitting our time today. I'm going to be sharing my 20 minutes with Mr. McBride equally. I've also set aside 2 minutes for rebuttal. There have been about two dozen Section 211F4 waiver applications presented to EPA. EPA, about half that time, has granted them.
You may want to very early get to the jurisdictional question here. Do you have standing?
The short answer is yes.
The long question would be, why do you have, how do you demonstrate that you have standing? Now tell me that one.
We can demonstrate it multiple ways, as the Court can tell from looking at these multiple petitioners. The first thing I'd do is to point out that many of these petitioners, the autos, the engines, NPRA, API, have been repeated stakeholders, sometimes even petitioners, in prior waiver cases. That's point one. But point two is when you look at
Article 3 context in which they've been held to have standing.
An Article 3 context in which they've been held to
have
standing.
We really don't care how many times they may have been to the agency.
Certainly.
You don't need standing for that. Is there a court that has held they have standing to raise this kind of challenge?
Yes, I think by analogy. And the two cases I'd point to most specifically are both cited in our brief. One of them is NRDC versus EPA. That's a case involving, among other things, a petition brought by Mack Trucks. It presents the prudential standing challenge that only growth, of course, has raised, not EPA. The other case is the Hazardous Waste Treatment Council case, also cited in our brief. That goes to the Article 3 standing case, the argument, also presented just by growth, not by EPA. But more significantly, Judge Sentell, to your question, it's not just the fact that these folks have been petitioners, interveners, or amici in past waiver cases. It's that many of these petitioners are regulated parties under the Clean Air Act and under the related provisions that bear on this particular waiver determination. Take the autos and engines, for example.
Are they regulated under the fuel provisions as to which the waiver is enacted?
The answer is absolutely yes as to the autos and engines. The fuel provisions, of course, specifically speak to the emission standards to which the vehicles have been certified. And as this Court has pointed out multiple times, when you look at standing and you look at the zone of interest that this particular provision covers.
In the zone of interest. Let's stay on Article 3 standing for the first.
Oh, Article 3 standing is even more, conclusive.
Pick out your best shot and tell me who is harmed by. Which of the petitioners is harmed by this waiver? You're here attacking the waiver, right?
That's correct.
It's harmed by the waiver, and how they are harmed in a fashion in which we can fix it, we can grant relief.
I can pick any of those, but I'll start with the autos and engines. What the autos and engines have alleged are two things. First, that the vehicles that are subject to the waiver, meaning the later model year vehicles, will fail, that EPA has not satisfied
they
its...
They will fail only if they pump the E15 fuel into them, right?
That's correct, but that's why I made the point that we're talking about the later model vehicles, the ones that actually are certified for use with E15. So I'm not talking about misfueling. That's a separate harm issue.
What happens to them?
What the autos and engines have alleged is that those vehicles, the vehicles that are approved for use for this new sort of partial waiver, will fuel with the E15 as they are allowed to do, and that they will suffer emissions failures. In that event, I'd point the Court to the warranty provisions of the Clean Air Act. This is 42 U.S.C. Section 7541. 7541, the warranty statute, setting aside consumer claims, setting aside liability, the warranty statute is essentially sort of a no-fault statute. Even if, and this is straight from the statute, if the administrator determines that a substantial number of any class or category of vehicles or engines, although properly maintained and used, don't conform to the emission standards. The administrator shall issue a recall, and unless the manufacturer can overcome that recall, the manufacturer has to incur certain costs and implement certain things to make that recall happen. That is a straightforward application of the merits argument that these autos and engines and the rest of the petitioners are making, that E15 will cause harm to vehicles that are certified for use, misfueling aside. I'd also point to API, NPRA, Western States, and ITLA. all of those gas and oil industry petitioners are also obligated parties under the renewable fuel standards.
So it's a combination for them. It's the combination of the ethanol mandate and the waiver provision.
It is, but that's not any kind of a sort of multiple link chain. EPA has said so itself. If you look at Joint Appendix 80, for example, what EPA says very clearly on that page is that it expects that E15 will supplant E10. What EPA said in the RFS2 regulations themselves are that the expanded RFS2 mandates mean that essentially all downstream blenders and terminals, in addition to refiners and importers, and all of those petitioners that I just named cover that entire category, are now regulated parties under RFS2, since essentially all gasoline will be blended with ethanol. So it's not any kind of a leap in logic to assume that those auto petitioners will incur harms, and to assume that the oil and gas petitioners will have to incur significant upfront costs in making changes to their transportation structures, to their storage structures, and to all of the infrastructures that support the refining and blending and marketing of E15 as opposed to E10.
With respect to the engine manufacturers, don't we have cases? Our cases seem to say that the risk of future litigation is not sufficient for Article III standing.
Well, Judge Tatel, that's why I made the distinction between the kind of consumer litigation that this court has expressed some discomfort with from the Article III standing perspective, and the kind of warranty obligations that attach if, as these auto and engine petitioners allege, E15 will cause failure in the cars that are certified to use it. I'm not even getting to misfueling yet, which is a significant problem for all of the cars and engines, of course, that aren't certified to use E15. But even as to that set of vehicles that EPA found E15 was appropriate for use, our merits argument is that EPA didn't do its job, and that there were, and during testing, and will be, significant failures of those vehicles. If we are right, which for standing purposes this court has to assume, then a warranty recall may follow. And that's the difference, I think, between the sort of hypothetical, hard to put your finger on, hard to identify the third party future litigation context that you're talking about, and the warranty context that I referred in 42 USC section 7541. The autos and engines are plainly regulated parties that are meant to be protected by this statute, after all. That's the whole reason for this rigorous waiver requirement, is to make sure that a fuel or a fuel additive that goes into an engine, which by necessity has already been already been designed, already been implemented, already been put on a production line, is able to satisfy that particular engine emission standard. It does not comport with reason to suggest that these engine manufacturers can't challenge a fuel additive that it claims will cause engine problems.
I want to make sure I understand. So your merits argument is, even if EPA has the authority to do a waiver for, say, just the post-01 cars, even if it has that authority, it has not properly exercised that authority here because E15 could damage even those engines.
That's
your argument?
That's part of our merits argument, and that's the portion of the argument that is the latter part of our brief. Mr. McBride will be addressing mainly those process and analytics issue. But our primary legal argument is the one that leads off our brief, which is that there is not a reading of Section 211F4 that supports the notion that EPA can partially waive the prohibition contained in 211F1.
You've got an excellent argument on merits. My problem is getting there, and that's why we urge you to go with the standing first.
Understood, Judge Santel, but I hope that my citations both to the auto and engines' specific harms and the nature of their status as regulated parties, and API, MPRA, and the other oil and gas petitioners' specific harms that they'll incur up front, those infrastructure harms I mentioned, and their status as regulated parties under the closely related RFS2 regulation, get you where you need to go, both for Article 3 and for prudential standing.
What about the food groups, if you had to rely on them alone? I guess the food group, that would depend on the prices going up, right, of corn.
It would, yes, for Article III standing. Then prudential standing, of course, it's EISA, which specifically instructs.
So again, there, for prudential standing on the food group, it's the combination of the renewable fuel standard and the waiver provision?
For prudential standing for the food groups, it's the fact that before EPA can allow ethanol into the market in such great quantities, it was required, among other things, to take into effect the price impact of that particular agricultural commodity. It did.
Not under 211F. It only has to balance under this statute increasing the quantity of ethanol against the potential damage to emission systems.
Not under Section 211F4 specifically, no. Right. But as this Court has pointed out, when it comes to prudential standing is a very low bar. You look not...
There is a bar.
There is a bar. But I would caution, too, that the way that Growth describes the prudential standing issue in its brief, it homes in on one of a few different tests. Yeah. What Growth focuses in on is 211F4 meant to benefit this particular petitioner? That, of course, is not the standard that Court has used.
That's what exactly the standard... Right. It has to be... We have to look at the whole statute.
You have to look at the whole statute.
But the other part of the statute we look at has to be integrally related, right?
That's true, but I would also add to that, Judge Tatel, that you look not just at whether the party is benefited, but whether the party is protected or whether the party is regulated. Those are the two concepts that are not mentioned in Gross' brief. All of these petitioners that we've been talking about this morning are either benefited or protected or regulated by the statute. The auto and engines are necessarily benefited by Section 211F4 because the whole purpose of that statute is to make sure that something doesn't get into a vehicle's engine that's going to cause those emission problems. The oil and gas petitioners are both protected and regulated by the statute. More broadly, because the whole purpose of that statute is to make sure that they can carry and that they can get to market the kind of gas fuel or fuel additives that this particular waiver provision is meant to encompass. The food petitioners are both protected and benefited by the RFS2 standards generally and by this renewable fuels implementation of that standard. Because EPA was instructed to take their particular needs, the commodity prices, into account. Any way you slice this, you get a petitioner with Article III and prudential standing. And, of course, as this Court has said multiple times, you need just one. And we'd submit we have more than one here.
We have also talked you out of your time, so we will hear from the co-petitioner.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Ken. May it please the Court. Most of the vehicles on the road today, and essentially all boats, chainsaws, lawnmowers, and other non-road engines, were not designed to use E15. It is clear that the non-road engines cannot accommodate it. The U.S. Coast Guard expressed grave concerns about the safety impacts on boaters if E15 is used in boats. Similar concerns were expressed about safety risks with other non-road engines, including chainsaws. As NPRA said, blades engage in the idle position. The risks to a chainsaw user in this example are profound and unacceptable. JA 213. Other non-road engines can also fail catastrophically with E15.
Can you add anything to what your co-counsel said on standing?
Yes, sir. And thank you for asking. Under Section 206, which applies to the new vehicles, Section 207 in use, and Section 213 for the non-road engines, these petitioners that I represent, the Engine Products Group, as we call them, are regulated by emissions limitations, first of all, that they have to certify to and that there is in-use testing to demonstrate compliance with. And if
how does this waiver,
yes,
what harm does this waiver cause them that we can remediate in this proceeding?
Happy to answer it, Your Honor.
Please.
At JA 71, which is the chart accompanying DOE's second waiver decision, DOE admits that one vehicle would fail. That's the 2002 Nissan Frontier. Now, if you can read the footnote, the asterisk footnote, it said that it passed, however, due to averaging. But their own regulations, and EPA includes them in its brief at Ad 43, require four similar vehicles for averaging for in-use testing. There weren't four similar vehicles here, so they can't average. That chart also indicates that the 2000 Honda Accord failed. EPA says, well, we can excuse that because it failed on both E15.
Which year? What
2000
year?
Honda Accord.
But I thought this only applied to post-2001 vehicles.
The 2000 Honda Accord was included in testing because its technology was Tier 2 compliant, as I understand it. And so DOE included that vehicle.
So it's considered subject to this waiver?
The vehicle as a 2000 model year would not be, but it was in the DOE testing.
Well, on standing, if it's not going to be included, then it's not going to be included for standing, is it?
Right.
Well, I'm just indicating they felt it relevant for testing purposes.
Well, suppose we don't.
Okay, fine. Then let me turn to JA-19, okay, which is the chart accompanying the first waiver decision. There is another failure there, the 2009 Ford Focus. This applies to both the Focus and the Accord that I'm about to tell you, the 2000 Accord. DOE excused that failure because it said, oh, the vehicle failed on both E0 and E15. But if you look at the testing data, my apologies to you, we didn't cite this in the reply brief, but it's in the record, JA 1781 and 1783, on four separate occasions. When the Honda Accord was tested, it was tested with E0, but it had been run on E15, and the data show the same on the Ford Focus. Then, thirdly, Judge Sentell, the 28J letter that the government submitted, also about the 2002 Nissan Frontier. The government now admits that the Nissan Frontier failed on a second pollutant. That in that case, NMOG, or non-methane organic gases. So we have two failures with the Nissan Frontier. Now, the government will hasten to add on its 28J letter, oh, but the failure occurred outside the full useful life. But the government, in this case, this is JA 58, applied the statute throughout the actual life of the vehicles for the misfueling mitigation condition. So the government cannot excuse this failure because it happened after the full useful life. So, for the vehicles to which the waiver would apply, we have failures. This waiver, therefore, Judge Sentell, alters our legal obligations because it would make us subject to recall by EPA for those vehicles because they would not comply with the emissions limitations to which those vehicles are subject. Now, there are two other categories of problems. The government concedes that there would be evaporative emissions violations. The government says, however, they can be excused because E15 will have less total evaporative emissions than E10. But our violations, if we were so alleged to have violated the statute, can't be excused by some kind of a set-off like that. A violation is a violation, and the government admits it. And then finally, with respect to NOx, the government admits the waiver will cause NOx, nitrogen oxides, to increase significantly. But the government never determined whether those emissions or the evaporative emissions would cause or contribute to failures of these vehicles to comply with the applicable emissions limitations. So we have multiple failures or issues with
and
respect
those
to violations.
Two, are those latter two also examples that would subject your clients to recalls? Is that what those are?
I'm sorry, the first part of your question?
The latter two, the evaporative and the NOx.
Yes.
Is that a basis for recall also?
As I understand it, it is, Your Honor.
So your theory of injury then is that these documented failures,
yes,
of the emission standards subject the manufacturers of these emission systems, right, to a recall?
Yes. And
the
statute so provides.
What statute says that?
Section 207, for example, which is applicable to in-use testing.
Right.
It reads, this is C1, when in actual use throughout their useful life is determined under Section 7521D of this title, he being the manufacturer, shall immediately notify the the administrator shall immediately notify the manufacturer thereof of such nonconformity, and he shall require the manufacturer to submit a plan for remedying the nonconformity of the vehicles or engines with respect to which such notification is given. And the same thing is true under 213 for the non-road engines. Finally, let me just address the misfueling mitigation conditions, which, so far as we can tell, are still in effect, even though there is a misfueling mitigation rule, which we've separately challenged and which the court has held in abeyance. The agency did not adopt robust misfueling measures. All it adopted was a label. There'll be one more label on the pump telling people not to use E15 if they don't have an appropriate vehicle, model year 2001 to the present, and don't use it in non-road engines. But in the past, for leaded, unleaded, as some of us may recall, when unleaded gasoline came in, there was a narrow nozzle on the pump so that you couldn't put the leaded gasoline in the new vehicle. And there was a barrier over the fuel tank. And several years later, EPA admits that there was intentional misfueling of at least 13.5%. People used a funnel to get the gas in because it was a few cents cheaper, and that's at JA3, among other places, and JA393. So I point out to you that we're going to have misfueling problems with the vehicles for which the waiver was not intended,
okay,
the older
now,
vehicles.
How do you fit that into your standing argument? And that's a very different argument, isn't it?
The way that fits, yeah. And thank you for asking, Judge Tatel, is if you go to the rule, which was included in the joint appendix at the government's request, at JA 1884 and 1913, the rule indicates, and now I'll start with 1913, for light duty and other motor vehicles not covered by the partial waivers, EPA notes that to avoid honoring an emissions warranty, a manufacturer must not only condition the warranty on the use of a fuel other than E15, it must also show, it says, that use of E15 was relevant to the reason that the motor vehicle failed emissions testing. EPA regulations for non-road equipment impose similar conditions on voiding warranties for non-road equipment.
What does that mean?
What that means is that we would have, the manufacturers would have the burden of showing that the vehicle failed due to the use of E15. But if it comes into the dealership with a failed engine and there's no E15 in the tank, it's not possible to show that. But the damage occurs along the way.
We're at a standing point here.
Yes,
there's lots of issues about saying that where the harm depends upon the intervention of third parties, that's too attenuated to grant standing.
Well, all I'm saying, Your Honor, is this rule purports to alter our legal obligations by imposing obligations on us to repair vehicles if we can't prove that people used E15 in them. That alters our legal obligations.
Well, that would have been your obligation if they didn't have the waiver?
No. No, because the warranty would be voided by the use of the E15.
You'd still have to prove it. You'd still have to prove it.
Well, this shifts the burden of proof.
I don't see how this waiver, I don't think that gives you standing under the waiver.
Well.
That's what you're here attacking.
This is now a rule that EPA has imposed that it didn't impose before to carry out this waiver.
Say again the difference between the circumstances under the waiver.
Yes.
And the circumstances prior to the waiver with respect to a car, a pre-01 car that's brought in because of failures due to E15. Now, that's not a warranty problem, right? You're not.
Well, we would say it's not a warranty problem. Somebody else may say it is.
I know, but
there'd be a dispute.
Prior to the waiver,
yes.
You don't have to worry. After the waiver, you don't have to worry about that because of your warranty. Doesn't cover the use of E15,
well, we
right?
Do, anyway, I don't want to quarrel with your hypothetical because I'm going to answer your question, but I do want to tell you that the government puts pressure on the manufacturers to repair even when the warranty doesn't apply. There have been lots of recalls like that by NHTSA. But in any event, let's accept your hypothetical that we don't have a warranty problem under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. We now have a rule that I've cited to you which gives EPA the purported authority to require us to make those repairs notwithstanding the warranty. This is separate from the warranty.
Waiver does that?
And that is because...
The rule does that.
The waiver, what are you attacking here today?
The waiver.
Right.
And I'm asking you to accept...
What the waiver does, as far as your standing.
Well, but Judge, I'm entitled to rely on the rule to show you my standing to challenge the waiver.
And what?
What is the rule? What is it the rule does that you didn't have before?
The rule purports to give EPA the authority to require us to repair vehicles unless we can prove that E15 was used in the vehicle and it wasn't supposed to be.
And why is that?
What standard of proof would have existed had there been no authorization of the use of E15?
Well, EPA would have to prove that the failure occurred due to some...
EPA is not involved in the first instance. In the first instance, you have a consumer who has an engine failure.
Under a warranty claim.
Under a warranty claim.
No, right? but what we're talking about here is a Section 207 order of a recall.
A recall order.
Okay. Yes. Yes. And
the rule now requires you to submit to a recall... I'm not sure what you're saying, that the thing you're attacking here... What we can get rid of here today is the waiver, right?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely.
That's the remedy we could grant in this litigation.
That is correct.
And how does the waiver...
I'm saying that...
Whatever it is you're saying happens now.
There won't be E15 in the market without the waiver. Mm-hmm. If you uphold the waiver or permit it to remain in effect, there will be E15 in the market. And then the liability that's purported to apply to us under the rule kicks in.
If somebody misuses E15.
Yes. No, well, they may deny that they do, but we may believe that they do, but unless we can prove that they did, we're liable, says EPA. See, what E15 does, if I may just try to give you a moment's tutorial here, that E15 degrades components of motors over time.
Particularly catalysts.
Right. But if the tank has E10 in it when the car comes in, we might suspect the E15. We may have seen a lot of vehicles that look just like that. Some vehicles fail even with the E10. But unless we can prove he used E15, we can't trigger our defense, according to EPA.
You mean that the damage might have been done by E15 that was used earlier but is no longer in the tank?
Absolutely.
Is that your point?
Just like the 2009 Ford Focus and the 2000 Honda Accord that DOE tested, the cars were run with E15 but tested with E0. Uh-huh. That's what I showed you at 1781 and 1783 of the Joint Appendix. That
so
happens.
We could fix your problem here simply by striking the burden of proof assignment. We wouldn't have to strike the whole E15 waiver.
Well, you don't have the rule before you right now. That's the problem. That burden of proof was not imposed on us in the misfueling mitigation conditions.
Okay, we don't have the rule before.
I'm sorry?
We don't have the rule before.
The rule's before the court, but it's held in advance. It's not part of these cases.
This litigation is the waiver.
That's correct.
And the problem is covered by the rule, not the waiver.
Yes, but for standing purposes, I'm entitled to rely on the rule to show
standing
the harm.
Standing purposes, you have to show us that we can remedy in this litigation.
Yes.
And a harm that is caused by
right.
the act of the
exactly.
entity under.
Exactly.
Now, the entity act, as I understand it, is the waiver.
And I accept that obligation.
And the remedy we can grant.
And the answer is, if you strike down the waiver for statutory reasons or other reasons, there won't be E15 in the marketplace, and we won't have these harms arise.
Okay. We've talked you out of your time as well. So
thank you very much.
From the EPA.
May it please the court, my name is Jessica O'Donnell with the Department of Justice. I'm here today representing EPA. With me at counsel's table is Susan Staley from the EPA's Office of General Counsel.
You don't challenge their standing, correct?
We do not challenge standing, and I understand your honors are interested in that question.
No, I'm just saying, do you agree they have standing? What's the basis for your not challenging?
Yeah, we do not challenge their standing because and I don't want to be in the awkward position of making petitioner standing arguments for them, but we do agree that they are, although they're not
effective.
Strictly regulated by the waiver, they are potentially regulated parties, and therefore their standing would be self-evident. We also understand that under this court's jurisdiction, only one petitioner needs to establish standing, and we think out of between the oil petitioners, the oil group petitioners, and the engine group petitioners, at least one of those two parties would be able to establish standing under the court's precedent.
Can I ask you?
We do.
You agree that I'm sorry. You go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I just wanted to continue on that. Is the reason that they have, the engine manufacturers have standing, well, what's your response to the argument you just heard about the fact that the record shows that there have been failures and that those failures will lead to recalls?
First I'll point out that I don't think that EPA, I'm not aware of any instance where EPA has recalled a vehicle under these regulations.
No,
I also think
EPA,
that
not EPA, the whoever, what's the agency that does recalls? The other agency.
Well, but the regulations that are, the recall authority that's at issue here would be EPA's recall authority.
Oh.
And I think in that context, you know, Judge Santel's point was correct that the waiver doesn't change the petitioner's the auto manufacturer's burden in the event they were subject to recall proceedings.
That was for, I thought, maybe I misunderstood, but I thought that was with respect to vehicles not covered by the waiver. I was asking you about waivers, about vehicles covered by the waiver, and counsel's argument.
I think another point.
2009 Nissan
what was
Frontier.
It? Yeah, what about that car?
Well, I think that for recall purposes, and I thought that this was mentioned in our brief, but I wasn't able to find it while I was listening to petitioner's argument. But for purposes of recall testing, the testing is done on E0. And so the fact that the vehicle may fail on E15 is somewhat irrelevant.
The presentation presented to us, it was fueled by E15 and then running on E0 so that there had been apparent harm due to the prior use of E15.
Well, I think the key, for our purposes, our analysis of the standing inquiry, the issue of whether E15 would cause emissions failures in any of these vehicles for which the waiver was approved really is tied up with the merits. Now, while it's EPA's position that the evidence in the record before EPA and EPA's engineering judgment shows that E15 will not cause or contribute to emissions failures. But we also recognize that for purposes of standing, the court, where the issue of harm and the issue before the court is, where the issue of harm is tied up with the merits, the court should assume standing and move forward to
that. Can I ask you another question on prudential standing? And you may not be prepared for this, but my understanding is that prudential standing at this point is not jurisdictional. And if it's not jurisdictional and the government hasn't raised it, an intervener can't raise prudential standing. Do you know, does the government have a position on that question? Do you know?
No, I'm embarrassed to admit, Judge Kavanaugh, that I'm not prepared to answer that question.
Okay.
I do think that this case does raise interesting questions with regard to prudential standing, of course, with regard to the food group petitioners, because
right.
I'm trying to figure
out whether we can even consider prudential standing, because I don't think under the Supreme Court's recent cases, and it's not ranked as jurisdictional, it's an interpretation of who can sue, kind of the class of plaintiffs. I don't think prudential standing is jurisdictional if the government doesn't raise it.
With regard to Article 3 standing, I do think that
there are potential issues
because, I mean, I think that their harm would be quite speculative, and so I...
Well, the prices are going to go up.
Who, for the grocery manufacturers?
Right, but prices may go up for a variety of reasons.
They're going to go up because more people are in the market for the purchase.
Don't think that's directly traceable to the E15 waiver.
So then
That's immediately traceable. It's not even a close... The prices are definitely going to go up. Don't you agree? Corn prices?
Well, I think they may or may...
Everyone in Congress in 2007, when they had the debate on the mandate, recognized that basic economic fact.
Right, but I think that there are a number of factors that may lead to that, and so I don't think it's the E15 waiver exclusively may lead. And also, I think I'd point out that the, excuse me for interrupting. No, but I think that the E15 waiver doesn't require anyone to manufacture or to sell E15. It merely is one step in the process for that.
The combination before that of the RFS and the waiver, right?
Well, but it, I mean, there. In this case, the issue is the validity of the E15 waiver, not the RFS mandate.
One without
and the I other? Also and I also think that E15.
Sorry to interrupt, but how can you look at one without the other? Because the reason the E15 is going waiver matters is because they're going to have to use E15 now to meet the mandate, and the two things together act to produce a requirement, a mandate, to introduce E15 into the gasoline supply.
Respectfully, Judge Kavanaugh, EPA would disagree that the RFS will require manufacturers or oil group members of the oil group petitioners to sell E15. It's only one option available to them for purposes of meeting the RFS requirements. And even the petitioners themselves in their brief admit that EPA in certain circumstances has the ability to waive the requirement. So I'm not suggesting that those circumstances exist. I don't want to suggest that those circumstances exist, but that's only one factor. I mean, we don't disagree that they are obligated parties, but the waiver is not their only, E15 is not the only.
On your last point, EPA's ability to grant a waiver can't defeat standing.
I'm sorry.
Someone who's injured, you said EPA could grant a waiver and that somehow defeats the standing. I think you said that.
I'm not suggesting that defeats their standing, but I do think it relates to their allegations, which is that RFS requires them to sell E15, and we disagree with
that.
I was
referring to waiver there. I was referring to waiver of the RFS.
I understand, yes.
So let me make sure I understand. So you don't think the food petitioners have standing? You don't think the fuel petitioners have? So is the agency's decision not to object to standing because you think the manufacturers do?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I don't want to be in the position of arguing the petitioners standing. Right. I do think of the three petitioners, the autos have
the
stronger arguments.
Okay. I just wanted to
Okay. Unlike my usual practice, I'm going to move past standing and actually go to the merits and ask you where the statutory authority comes from for the grant of this partial waiver.
Well, let me start with the language of the statute, and in response to your comment in an argument earlier today, I'm not going to, I will try not to include the ellipses. I perhaps might go back, because the statutory provision is somewhat long, I might go back and sort of insert some ellipses. But the key standard is EPA may grant a waiver if it determines the new fuel will, and here I'm starting the quote, will not cause or contribute to a failure of any emission control device.
Give me the citation to what you're quoting.
I'm quoting from section 211F4 of the statute, 7545F4.
7545F4?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
And I'm starting about halfway down. The administrator may grant a waiver if it determines it will not cause or contribute to a failure of any emission control device or system over the useful life of the motor vehicle engine, non-road engine, or non-road vehicle in which such device or system is used to achieve compliance by the vehicle or engine with the emission standards with respect to which it has been certified. That is quite a mouthful, I think.
But there, it all comes down to one word, right? Any.
I think EPA's view is that this case is not about the word any. True, the statute says EPA must determine that fuel will not cause or contribute to the failure of any emission control device or system, but that's not all the statute says. A failure of any emission control device or system to achieve compliance by the vehicle or engine with the emission standards with respect to which it has been certified. The fact that the language on its face means
that can't be done for model year 2000 and earlier, correct?
I'm sorry?
That can't be, the emission standards can't be met for model year.
That's right. EPA concluded the waiver is not appropriate for model year 2000 and older. But for purposes of model year 2001 and newer vehicles, EPA concluded that that E15 would not cause or contribute to failure of any emission control device or system within that subset of vehicles. So EPA's interpretation of the statute serves, the plain meaning of those words. Just going back to
I missed that. How does it serve the plain meaning? It says any, and you admitted not going to work for the 2000 and earlier.
But with respect to the vehicles for which EPA did grant the waiver, EPA determined that.
So it's a partial waiver.
That's right. It's a partial waiver.
EPA ever done that before?
It has not.
The vehicles for which EPA granted the waiver.
Right.
The waiver speaks in terms of waivers for fuel or fuel additives, not of vehicles.
Right. But the standard for EPA to grant the waiver is whether the fuel will cause a failure in the emissions system of the vehicle. So because the statute refers to the singular vehicle, it's really unclear whether the statute itself doesn't speak to the precise question at issue.
So we're getting away from the plain language statement should probably be retracted, right? You should proceed now on a reasonable interpretation.
That's right. I don't believe that this is, I think there is some confusion about that in petitioner's reply brief. Let me make clear, EPA doesn't think that this is a Chevron 1 case. This is clearly a Chevron 2 case.
I understood you just referred to the plain language, and I thought you were making a Chevron 1 claim.
No.
Perhaps I misunderstood.
No, I misspoke. I apologize. Okay. So the language refers to the vehicle. It doesn't speak to the precise question of whether EPA may grant a waiver for all vehicles, as petitioners argue, or whether EPA may grant a waiver for a subset of vehicles. EPA's interpretation of the statute to allow it to grant a waiver for only a subset of vehicles is reasonable when you look at the words of the statute and some of the statutory amendments that occurred over the history of the statutory provision. First of all, Section 211F4 must be read in conjunction with 211F1. F4 is a waiver of the prohibition in 211F4. Initially, so EPA's interpretation of the statute is that its waiver authority is coextensive with whatever is the class of vehicles that are addressed by Section 211F1.
Talking about D1? I'm sorry, E1?
No.
C1. Judge, whatever.
F1. F1, yes. Yes. Over time, both F1 and F4 have been expanded to cover an increasingly broad categories of vehicles. Initially, F1 was EPA interpreted to apply to solely to vehicles that used unleaded gasoline. In 1990, Congress amended F1 to include heavy-duty vehicles, which would include diesel vehicles.
How does this inform F4's use of the word any?
Well, in F4, Congress amended it in the EISA to include a reference to non-road vehicles, for example. There's a big difference, and that sort of expands. That's another expansion of.
Is the F1 version in your JSA, is that not current? Now, F1 in your SA refers to light-duty motor vehicles manufactured after model year 1974.
Right. But if you look at F1B, and it's on page ADD8 of our statutory addendum. So F1A applies
F1A
to light-duty motor vehicles.
Light-duty.
Which in 77, this provision was added to the Clean Air Act. Congress was looking or instructed EPA to look only at light-duty vehicles, which EPA interpreted to mean, vehicles using unleaded gasoline. But if you look at F1B, effective November 15th, 1990,
keep going.
The prohibition is expanded to any fuel or fuel additive for use by any person in any motor vehicles manufactured after 1974. Mm-hmm. So basically any vehicles in the national fleet.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that helps what you're asking us to do with F1-4, the definition of any in F1-4. How are you better off by the wording of what you just read?
Well, if there's a point about any that I didn't get to make earlier. The reason why this case isn't about the word any is because any simply refers to the emission control device or system in the vehicle. So this means any part of EPA has to look at any part of the emission system. But it doesn't answer the question whether EPA has to look at all emission control systems at in the national fleet at once, or if EPA may look at subcategories
it's
of vehicles.
It's a failure of any one. This is a strictly worded statute, I think, with a purpose in mind that may or may not be good policy, but it's strictly worded. Failure of any means you can't do it.
But it means that EPA, we don't dispute that any is to be given expansive meaning, but what any modifies is any emission control device or system. So, and if you look at the legislative history indicates that Congress intended that to mean the entirety of the entire emission performance of the vehicle. And this is cited in EPA's brief, and we also have the legislative history included in our addendum. So you're not, that still doesn't answer the question of which vehicles are you looking at.
You helped yourself any with that
one. I'm sorry?
I'm not sure how you just helped yourself any with that. You didn't even address the question.
Right, if it doesn't address the question, then EPA is entitled to some discretion as to how it interprets the statute. And it's reasonable, given the wide variety of vehicles and engines on the road today, for which different types of emission systems.
But if you look at F1A and F1B, the universe of vehicles covered by this statute is quite broad and includes a lot of vehicles. And then you come down here and want to make a waiver that doesn't interpret any, it seems to exclude any. How can we hold that to be a reasonable interpretation when it's not really an interpretation at all?
It is, in fact, because the vehicles and engines covered by both F1 and the waiver in F4 is so broad, and because they contain different vehicle emission systems that may or may not react differently to different types of fuel, then it is reasonable for EPA to examine.
Is the administrator interpreting any to mean some? Is that what we're being told?
We aren't.
What is the interpretation that we should hold as reasonable?
We think that the term any refers to modifies the emission control device or system in the vehicle.
We start.
This means that EPA needs to look at for each vehicle that EPA is looking at, or each class of vehicles that EPA is looking at. It's got to look, from the tailpipe all the way to the engine. It has to look at the entire emissions performance of the vehicle. But that doesn't answer in EPA's view, that doesn't answer the question whether EPA may look at vehicles as
whether EPA may create a partial waiver is our.
That's point. Right. Whether EPA may
if
group
we construe any strictly, as Judge Kavanaugh suggests, then how can EPA grant a partial waiver?
Because EPA is determining that for any that E15 will not cause the emissions control systems in any. And it will not cause the failure of any emission control system in
subject
2001.
To
exactly,
right.
2001
that's
to 2000.
Subject to the waiver.
Right. Okay. Right.
So even if you're right
EPA
about that,
EPA has examined.
Yeah. Even if you're right about that, EPA is. I want to ask you about the older cars, pre 2000 cars.
2000 and older.
Yeah, the misfueling problem.
Yes.
EPA has conceded that it will result in failures for some of those, right?
Well, I think EPA recognizes that it can't control.
Yeah. So it's and the regulation says that it's issued regulations to minimize the potential, right? The potential that'll be used. But the fact is that even if you're right about your first argument, the agency's conceded that there will be failures in the pre-2000 cars.
Well, and EPA has denied a waiver for those vehicles, and I think
but you've conceded it says you've minimized them. That's all. There will be failures, even though the waiver doesn't apply to them.
But they're not approved. EPA is not authorizing E15 for use in those.
You're not, but you've conceded that misfueling could lead to failures.
EPA, right.
And so the waiver will result in, the waiver will produce failures in some cars, which is not the same as none.
Well, but EPA has, I mean, under an arbitrary and capricious standard of review.
I'm talking about interpreting the statute. This is, any causes you, any creates two problems for the agency. Any creates a problem at the waiver stage with respect to whether that's permissible, and it also creates a problem for the pre-2000 cars that aren't subject to the waiver, because the agency has to certify that the waiver will not cause a failure of any emission device. And the agency's conceded that because of misfueling, it will for the pre-00 cars.
And that is why EPA denied the waiver. And so I think that in denying the waiver,
the waiver, it will, because there'll be misfueling.
But EPA has taken steps to prevent misfueling. I mean,
minimize them, not prevent it. That's my point.
I think looking at the statute, EPA needs to, the question for EPA is whether the fuel will cause or contribute to any emissions failures in the subset of vehicles that EPA is looking at. EPA determined with regard to 2001 and newer vehicles that E15 would not cause or contribute to emissions failures and properly granted the waiver. Applying the statutory standard. Applying the statutory standard to 2000 and older vehicles, EPA determined that using the E15 in those vehicles could cause or contribute to emissions failures, and it properly denied the waiver.
On the legislative history you mentioned earlier, does that refer specifically to partial waivers?
No, it does not. The legislative history is explaining...
Or to waivers of subsets?
No, the legislative history that I reference is explaining what Congress meant by the phrase any emission control device or system.
No indication in their committee reports or any statements on the floor, correct me if I'm wrong, that EPA can grant partial waivers or can grant waivers to subsets of classes.
No, that's right. There's also no legislative history indicating that EPA can't do that. There is legislative history.
You're looking at it, from my viewpoint at least, entirely wrongly when you say that. Now, of course, I don't look at legislative history, but you seem to be proceeding to the proposition we can do whatever the law tells us. We can do anything we want to as long as the law doesn't say we can't. I think that's got it backward. I think you have to show, and I think we have plenty of case law on this, that you can do it and under the statute.
Well, and that's an argument that petitioners make in their reply brief, but I don't think that's what EPA is doing. I think EPA is interpreting an authority that Congress gave it. The authority is to grant a waiver when the statutory standard has been met.
At least twice you've been asked, where in the statute does it give you the authority to do that? And each time you have started early with the proposition, well, the statute doesn't say we can't. What we're trying to find out is where the statute says you can.
My immediately prior comment was that the statute authorizes EPA to grant a waiver under certain conditions. EPA believes that you can reasonably interpret those conditions to authorize a waiver for a partial waiver.
I'm much longer than your allotted time, so unless my colleagues have further questions, we will hear from the intervener.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Judge Santel, and may it please the court. I'd like to pick up with the discussion of standing, and if I have 30 seconds to discuss the merits, I'll turn to the merits as well. Both this court and the Supreme Court have held that standing is substantially more difficult to establish where the party challenging the agency action is not the object of some regulatory burden that it seeks to set aside. Here, despite the long list of petitioners, not a single petitioner is objecting to the imposition of a regulatory burden upon it. Let me take each of the three groups in turn. First, with respect to the engine manufacturers, their contention is that someday they may be held accountable if E15 is used in vehicles, either the pre-2001 vehicles or the post-2001 vehicles, it causes damage in that vehicle, and either someone brings a warranty action against the auto manufacturer or engine manufacturer, or the EPA takes some action. That is insufficient to establish standing for many reasons. Let me focus on just a couple. First, the petitioners have not shown any plausible theory of actual liability that they would sustain. And in fact, they don't themselves say that they would be responsible or that they would sustain liability. They simply say that there might be misguided actions or baseless actions brought against them they themselves might find difficult to defend. With respect to the warranty claim, they themselves concede that there are no current vehicles other than flex fuel vehicles, which are treated separately, that are warranted to use E15. There would be no basis for a warranty claim in light of that. With respect to the recall issue, they point to Section 207C. It's also been referred to today as Section 7541C. That section does provide that under certain circumstances that the EPA can recall vehicles where the vehicles fail to satisfy the emission standards. But there are a number of limitations on that provision. For example, it only applies where there are a substantial number of vehicles that would fail. And petitioners have not done anything here to indicate in any way that there is a likelihood that there would be a substantial number of failures. In addition, the provision is limited. And this court, in the Chrysler case, made clear that there are significant limits on the EPA's recall authority. The court wrote, unless the cause of nonconformity, that is the failure to meet the emission standard, is within the manufacturer's control, an imposition of liability would be an unwarranted financial burden on the manufacturers, unrelated to the strategy of forcing technological progress, which is the reason for permitting recalls under that provision. But on top of all of that, it seems highly, highly unlikely that the EPA, which has concluded that, in fact, there is not a basis, or that there is a basis to permit the use of this fuel, would turn around and say, you know what, we got this so wrong, we made such a mistake, we're going to recall the vehicles. And in fact, there's a separate authority that EPA has that it's referred to elsewhere that it would be much more likely to use if it ever determined that it had made a mistake. And that is in Section 211C, which allows it to regulate a fuel that is already in the market. So if the EPA were to conclude that there were a problem with the fuel and it were causing damage to the engines, the remedy would not be to recall the engines, but to take some further step with respect to the fuel.
Can you address the petroleum group?
They
seem, combined with the RFS and the waiver, seem to operate together to mandate use of E15, or effectively mandate.
Your Honor, I mean, and I think it's important they use the word effectively.
Yeah.
There is nothing
in the real world, as opposed to.
Well, yeah, and I'm not sure that's true in the real world either. To start with, you're talking about statutory regimes that were adopted at entirely different points in time, nearly 40 years apart from each other. The waiver provision was adopted in 1977. The original renewable fuel standards were adopted in 2005 and then in 2007. But on top of that, there's nothing in the waiver itself that requires the marketing of E15. They say it effectively requires it. It doesn't require it. What it does is it removes a barrier. They're still free not to market it. They then point to a separate provision in the renewable fuel standards and say that the renewable fuel standards require that we market renewable fuels, and the only way that we can do this is with E15. Well, even putting aside the fact that I don't see how letting them market E15 in a way that would allow them to satisfy a separate statutory obligation gives rise to standing with respect to E15, but that's also not even the correct understanding of the way the renewable fuel standards operate. It's extremely technical, but my understanding of the way the renewable fuel standard operates is that every refiner or importer has to obtain a certain number of RINs. It's renewable identification number, which they obtain in one of two ways, either by purchasing the fuel from a renewable fuel manufacturer or by purchasing credits or RINs on the market, which have been separated from the fuel itself. They're still required to do that. Striking down the waiver in this case would do nothing to relieve them of that obligation, and that is the obligation that they're objecting to. So there's no traceable harm caused by the E15 waiver to the renewable fuel standards, and there's no redressability with respect to it either. They don't like the renewable fuel standards. They can separately challenge them, and indeed, there's a separate case pending before this court right now brought by the American Petroleum Institute, in which the API is challenging a decision by the EPA with respect to the standards for cellulosic
ethanol. So I want to make sure I cover everything. Can you also address the food group?
Your Honor, with respect to the food group, their argument is that the increased use of ethanol in E15 will increase demand for corn, increase corn demand for corn will then push up the price of corn, which will
that's all true, right? That's just obviously true.
I don't think it's obviously true, Your Honor. I think it's actually, a very complicated question. As we know, for example, from recent events.
Didn't all the members of Congress in 2007 who talked about this recognize the direct effect between the ethanol mandates and food prices?
Yeah, Your Honor, but there have been a couple of intervening events. One is that Congress, effective at the end of 2011, repealed the tax credit for ethanol. It repealed the tariff with respect to ethanol. These markets are complicated markets in how they operate. And we know, for example, with respect to current fuel prices, that the price is driven more by what the speculators are doing in markets than anything else. So I think that there's some significant question about how that would actually operate, but I don't think that that's actually the fundamental problem with their argument. The argument, among other things, proves way too much. I mean, if the argument is that someone has standing to challenge a deregulatory act because that act of deregulation will then create additional demand for an input into whatever industry has been deregulated, and that may then affect price, there would be very little limit on standing. And in fact, the proposition that I started off with, that it's substantially more difficult to establish standing in a deregulatory case where someone is challenging deregulation, would be flipped on its head.
I mean, that's certainly true. We've said that quite a bit. Do you have a case that says what you just said about the affecting the price is not sufficient for standing?
Florida Audubon may come close. I can't, for reasons I'm not going to go into, I can't get at Westlaw right now.
Okay. Well, thank you, Your Honor.
I think the en banc in Florida Audubon speaks of an attenuated chain of causation.
I think it would be highly attenuated. But, Your Honor, on top of that, with respect to the food group, it's hard to imagine, assuming the court does reach prudential standing.
I'm not sure it's jurisdictional, and I'm not sure you therefore can raise that.
Okay, let me address your question first, and then I'll address why I think there's no prudential standing.
And again, I'm just trying to cover all the angles here. That's why I'm asking these series of questions.
I very much appreciate the opportunity to respond to your questions. With respect to the fact that it was interveners that have raised this argument and not the government that's raised the argument, the interveners are full and complete parties in this case. We are not here as amici in this case. We actually are a regulated party. We are subject to the decision. We are very much affected by what this court does in the case, in this case in a very direct manner. And as full parties in the case, I would think that we would have the ability to raise any argument.
There's a case law that says interveners can't raise issues that haven't been raised except in extraordinary circumstances.
Well, I would think, Your Honor, that
this is extraordinary.
Well, I would think that going to the court's standing, going to the court's jurisdiction would fall into that category. But on top of that, if there's a question here of whether the issue is properly raised or waived, if this is not an argument that the petitioners have ever raised in the case. And so if there's a question of waiver or the issue is not properly before that, I would think that the fact that the petitioners have not raised it, and had the petitioners actually raised it in their briefing, it would have provided the government with an opportunity.
Well, the government,
to decide whether to take a
government
position.
Could have challenged their prudential standing. I think you got off track there in some fashion.
It is true that the government could have challenged their prudential standing,
right.
But it's certainly their obligation under this court's Sierra Club decision to establish standing, and to at the earliest time sort of articulate their basis for it. The government didn't challenge it. We did challenge it, and they certainly did not come back in their reply brief and say, well, wait a second, that argument was waived because it's only being raised by the interveners. And finally, I would say that as I understood what the government was saying earlier in response to the court's questions, the government did in fact indicate that it at least had significant questions about the standing of the food.
Well, that's different than asserting a prudential standing issue in its briefs.
Well, it's true that the government
did not. It's not jurisdictional, and interveners can't raise it. That may be a problem. Do you have this is beyond the scope of the briefs, but do you have a position on the jurisdictional question? It does seem like prudential standing, given the modern meaning the last 5 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence, would be difficult to consider jurisdictional.
Well, I don't think it's jurisdictional in the sense of falling within Article 3, I mean, because that's obviously the distinction, but I do think...
Well, the distinction is whether it can be forfeited or waived. That's the distinction.
Right, Your Honor.
Jurisdictional can't be forfeited or waived if it...
Right. Your Honor, I am not aware of any precedent, and I'll be happy to go back and look, but I'm not aware of any precedent that stands for the proposition that prudential standing is waived when it's not raised in the briefs. And I would think, actually, that it would be very similar to the notion that courts themselves examine their own jurisdiction. And there's good reason for that with respect to not just Article III standing, but prudential standing, because the purpose of prudential standing, like the purpose of Article III standing, is to ensure that the courts don't find themselves entangled in policy disputes.
True, but consider a statute that says securities dealers can sue the SEC, but customers cannot. You know, who can sue? No one would say that's jurisdictional, and that's essentially what the zone of interest test does. It says certain class of plaintiffs can sue and others can't, and I have difficulty. Again, Supreme Court's been very tough in recent years on what we can classify as jurisdictional.
And they've specifically
instructed lower courts to pay better attention to it.
But, Your Honor, I would say that if it is not jurisdictional, I would assert that we have raised it, that the interveners have had every opportunity to respond to it. They have not themselves argued that there's any waiver with respect to the issue. If I may, just 30 seconds on the merits.
They've waived the waiver.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have used that language.
Yes. No, thank you, Your Honor. Just 30 seconds on the merits with the court's indulgence.
30 seconds, and then you're through.
Thank you, Your Honor. With the construction of the statute in the word "any" that the petitioners are positing here, is just one that can't make sense in the light of the overall structure and purposes of the statute. Because under their construction of the statute, it would mean that if the EPA were to conclude that taking E15 and putting it into any engine, including a diesel engine, including a engine which is a flex fuel engine for E85, if you put it into any engine and it would cause damage to the catalytic converter or some other portion of the emission system, then you can't certify. That can't be what the statute means. And in fact,
why not?
Well, because I think it's inconsistent with the overall structure of the statute, with the purpose of the statute, and the question is. Any
you
what?
Certify any gasoline if they had to satisfy a diesel engine, if it had to run in a diesel engine.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You could never certify gasoline if it had to run in a diesel.
That's correct. And if someone were to put, but if someone were to put diesel into that engine, I am confident it would cause damage in that engine. So that can't be what the statute means. The statute means when it the word "any" means any, but the question is any what? And what I would submit is what it means is any engine for which EPA has concluded that fuel may appropriately be used. And if it didn't mean that, it would mean that the EPA could never grant a waiver, for example, if it concluded that there was one model of a leaf blower or a chainsaw out there that would fail to meet its emissions control standard.
And what about the misfueling problem?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What about the misfueling problem?
With respect to misfueling,
yeah.
Your Honor?
The fact that we know there will be misfueling with respect to pre-01 cars.
Your Honor, what I would say with respect to misfueling is that the Currently, if for their misfueling to occur, it would require someone to ignore what the manufacturer tells them. It would require them to ignore what it says on the pump. It would require them to ignore what the law compels and where the pump labeling says it's unlawful.
I'm not talking about standing. I'm talking about the merits.
Yes, Your Honor, but going to the merits on that, I mean, I do actually think that that is an alternative construction of the statute that actually supports the government's position, which is the government has first raises the argument that I've just raised.
My only point is that all the government has said is going to reduce the risk of refueling, not eliminate it, which means that even if you're right about the waiver authority, there will be pre-01 engines.
I see your point.
Right? That's my point.
Yes, Your Honor, but...
Now to an arbitrary and capricious question.
Fair enough. I understand.
That's a statutory question. In other words, they will be... You will, even if you're right about the waiver, you still can't say there will be no engines that will not fail because of the misfueling problem.
And that is always going to be the case, Your Honor, because someone some morning may wake up, inadequately wake up and put E85 into their car. The fuel pumps don't preclude that. I mean, there are all sorts of things. People might put butane in their car. People can do a lot of things that are not wise out there that could lead to failure of the system.
I think introducing E15 into the market, the EPA has opened the possibility of that occurring. That's the problem.
Well, that's true, but that's true when any fuel is introduced into the market, is that someone could ignore.
We have this waiver to deal with here, and we have the plain language of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, that is true, but if the court were to go so far as to say that any risk of misfueling, any risk that someone would ignore the instructions, ignore the law, and put the wrong substance in their car is sufficient basis to keep the fuel off the market, then the EPA's hands are going to be tied, and there's going to be very little that they can do. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Did anybody have any time left for rebuttal? Okay, we'll give you 2 minutes back for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two brief points on standing and then 2 brief points on the merits, if I can. First,
we'll give you 4 minutes back for rebuttal. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I'd like to divide my time with my co-counsel. First, Judge Kavanaugh, on your prudential standing question, you know, the point that you're making, I think, is what the Supreme Court has said about jurisdiction having many, too many meanings. Whether prudential standing is jurisdictional, quasi-jurisdictional, as some courts have said, or non-jurisdictional, we're happy to supply additional briefing on it. We don't think that we've waived that waiver because, of course, the prudential standing issue wasn't even raised until the opposition brief. But in any event, that's all beside the point here, where you have multiple parties with both Article III and prudential standing. I commend government counsel for her candor. She was in a difficult position, acknowledging that with respect to the autos and engines, the harm that they're alleging, of course, is their merits argument. And Mr. Moss's attempts to brush aside the merits arguments have no place in a standing analysis. With respect to the oil and gas industry, it is a fiction that these industry members will not be required to carry E15. I'll put it that bluntly. They do not have a choice, or their choice is a Hobson's choice. They can either not carry E15 and fold, or concede all of their market share to a company that carries E15, or they can carry it. EPA intends, and they've said it plainly at Joint Appendix 80, that E15 will supplant E10 in this market. These industry members are obligated to carry it, and they will. Briefly on the merits, a couple points. The first is this notion that the word "the" in the statute has any weight, I think should be quickly rejected. When you look at the statute, the word "any," the phrase "any emission control device or system," is then followed by a parenthetical, and this is a parenthetical that I think has meaning. Over the useful life of the motor vehicle, engine, non-road engine, or non-road vehicle in which such device or system is used. What is the vehicle? What is the engine? It's the vehicle in which that emissions control system is used.
What do you do with intervener's argument that I enhanced, I agree, but nonetheless, if you have a diesel engine and you put any gasoline in it, you've ruined that engine.
That is another fiction, Your Honor. The argument that defeats our plain statutory meaning analysis is a fiction. Here's the problem, and it actually goes to a point that EPA's counsel made as well. When you look at F1 and F4, they are, as EPA's counsel explained, meant to be read together with each other. What F1 says is the EPA administrator prohibits any fuel that's not substantially similar to any certification fuel, meaning any one. A fuel or fuel additive can be waived in by way of F4 if it is found to be of like fuel. So you can get a fuel or fuel additive waived in under F4 if it's a additive to gas or to diesel or to E85. It doesn't have to satisfy all. It's a like fuel to like fuel measure. Finally, the last point I would leave you with is the point that EPA's counsel kept returning to, which is this notion that where the statute, and this is Ms. O'Donnell's words, if it doesn't address the issue, EPA has the discretion. Judge Santel, you pointed out that's not the law. What API versus EPA said in this case, in this court, is just because a statute doesn't speak in thou shalt not terms doesn't mean that EPA has the discretion to do something the statute specifically precludes it from doing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I believe the time is up and the case will be submitted. Give us recess.
Yeah, that's supposed to be our